Okay, so you're a defense attorney, right? And your client is facing trial for domestic violence.
Okay.
And the prosecution's key piece of evidence, a 911 call where the victim describes the attack,
Right.
but never shows up to actually testify. Could that 911 call be enough to put your client in jail?
Yeah, it's a that's the question at the heart of Davis v. Washington, a Supreme Court case that's been kind of a thorn in the side of lawyers ever since it was decided back in 2006.
Yeah, this definitely seems like one of those cases that comes up a lot, right? It seems like it would be pretty common.
Oh, absolutely. And what makes Davis so interesting is it forces us to really examine like a core tension in our legal system. On the one hand, you have the victim's cry for help, captured in that 911 call, really raw, powerful
Well,
evidence.
sure.
But then on the other hand, you have the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause, which guarantees a defendant the right to confront their accuser face to face. So how do you reconcile those two things?
That's where things get tricky, right? Because if the victim isn't there to testify in person, is using that 911 call a violation of the defendant's right to, cross-examine?
Exactly. And this case didn't just kind of appear out of nowhere. The Supreme Court had already been dealing with, wrestling with this issue back in Crawford v. Washington. A few years earlier, that case established that the Confrontation Clause only applies to what they call testimonial statements.
Testimonial statement.
But it left a lot of people scratching their heads about what testimonial actually means.
Yeah, it's like they said, here's this thing, but they didn't really, define what it was.
Exactly.
Okay. So then Davis v. Washington, it was basically the Supreme Court saying, okay, we see there's some confusion. Let's set some clearer rules.
Precisely. The Davis case was the court stepping in and finally providing a framework, a test, if you will, for determining what exactly makes a statement testimonial.
Okay, so walk me through this test. What's the magic formula they came up with?
So they call it the primary purpose test, and it's actually pretty straightforward. It
Okay.
has two parts. The first one is if the primary purpose of the statement is to help police respond to some ongoing emergency, it's not considered testimonial.
Okay. So basically, if someone's in a dangerous situation and they call 911, their main goal is to get help, not to, build a case for a trial down the road.
Exactly. Think of it like this. If someone's on a 911 call and they're yelling, he's got a gun, and they're not thinking about evidence or, building a legal strategy.
Right.
They're thinking about survival.
Of course, yeah. Okay, so that makes sense. So what about the second part of the test?
So the second part says, if the primary purpose of a statement is to gather evidence for a future trial, well, then it is considered testimonial.
Okay, so it all comes down to the why behind the statement. What was the speaker's main objective at that time?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so if we go back to the facts of the Davis case itself, Michelle McCautry called 911 during a domestic violence incident with her ex-boyfriend, Adrian Davis. On that call, she named him as her attacker, and she described what was happening.
But she ended up not testifying the trial, right? Leaving the prosecution with just that 911 call as evidence.
Right. So the question for the court was to examine, was that call, were those statements made on that call to get help right away or to build a case for later on?
Okay, so what did they decide? Was her 911 call a frantic plea for help, or was it essentially like a sneak preview of her potential testimony?
In the end, the court ruled that her statements were non-testimonial, and they emphasized, the fact that she was describing the event as it was happening, in a really frantic and chaotic situation.
Okay. So the 911 operator's questions were aimed at getting her out of harm's way, not on prepping her for trial.
Exactly. I mean, imagine you're that 911 operator. You're hearing yelling and maybe sounds of struggling. Your questions are going to be focused on figuring out what's going on right then and there. How many people are involved? Are there weapons?
Yeah.
The kind of information you need to get help there immediately.
Right, to make sure everyone's safe.
Right. You're not exactly thinking, how do I prep this witness for a future trial?
Exactly, yeah. Makes sense. But didn't you mention that Davis v. Washington also had a companion case, another case that was decided on the same day?
Yes, Hemin v. Indiana is a really interesting contrast to Davis.
Okay.
In Hemin, the police responded to a domestic violence call, but when they arrived, things were calm. The husband and wife were in separate rooms.
So no more active emergency happening.
Exactly. But the police went ahead and questioned Mrs. Hemin about what had happened,
Okay.
getting a detailed account of the alleged assault from her.
So I'm guessing the court saw that differently from the Davis case, since the immediate danger had passed.
That's right. The court ruled that that Mrs. Hammond's statements were testimonial, you know, because the emergency was over at that point. And so the questioning really shifted from resolving the crisis to gathering evidence. It was much more like a police interview than that frantic 911 call.
Yeah, wow. So the timing and the context of it all, they really are everything in these cases. It's not just about whether a statement was made to the police. It's about the whole situation surrounding it.
Exactly. The Davis and Hammond cases together really drive home how crucial those factors are. They really sort of, they try to paint a picture of where that line is, or at least where the court thinks it should be.
Which brings up a question I bet a lot of lawyers are thinking. If this whole primary purpose test is based on intent, how can you actually know what's going on in someone's head when they're making a statement, especially during a crazy situation like a 911 call?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And it's one that we're going to unpack in part two of this deep dive. We'll explore how courts try to untangle this really knotty issue of intent.
Okay, looking forward to that.
And what kind of evidence they look for to try to determine that.
Sounds like we're just getting started.
Yeah. You know, when you really start thinking about Davis, you realize it's not just about these 911 calls or even just domestic violence cases. Mm-hmm. It really gets at like the core of what the Confrontation Clause is supposed to protect and how we're supposed to be interpreting, you know, these fundamental rights in today's world. Right.
Yeah. It's almost like a philosophical debate that's kind of disguised as a legal case.
Exactly. And no one really embodied that more than Justice Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion in the Davis case.
Right.
He was a staunch originalist.
Meaning he believed the Constitution should be interpreted based on its original meaning, how the Founding Fathers intended it.
Exactly. Yeah, so. And Scalia argued that the Confrontation Clause was specifically designed to prevent the kind of abuses that happened back in the 17th century, you know, in those English courts, where, you know, defendants were often convicted based on secret accusations or testimony given outside of court. They never even got to see their accuser face to face.
So for Scalia, the Davis case was all about upholding that central idea, making sure that the Confrontation Clause wasn't weakened or watered down.
Exactly. He saw this this primary purpose test as a way to ensure that modern day defendants still had, you know, that very basic right to challenge, you know, the evidence that's being used against them.
Which is super important when you consider what's at stake here, right?
Right.
We're not just talking about like fines or community service.
Yeah.
A criminal conviction could mean losing your freedom, your job, you know, your reputation, your whole life. Really.
Absolutely. The consequences are huge. And that's why the reliability of the evidence is so crucial.
Right.
You know, the Confrontation Clause isn't just about protecting the rights of the person accused. It's also about protecting the integrity of the system as a whole.
It's making sure we're not sending people to prison based on evidence that's shaky or hasn't been thoroughly vetted.
Right. And, you know, think about it, that right to cross-examine witnesses, it allows the defense to really poke holes in the prosecution's case, right?
Yeah.
Maybe there are inconsistencies in their story, or the witness has a reason to lie. Maybe they just misremembered something. Cross-examination brings those issues to light.
It forces the prosecution to be super thorough, to you know, build a solid case.
Right.
And it gives the jury all the information they need to make the right call.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, that's why that primary purpose test is so important. It's the court's attempt to deal with the unique challenges of, you know, statements that are made in these emergency situations,
right,
trying to balance the need for, you know, for reliable evidence with the need to respond to urgent situations.
Okay, so let's say I'm a lawyer and I'm working on a case where a 911 call is the main piece of evidence.
Right.
How do I actually use this primary purpose test? Like, what exactly am I looking for?
It's all about the context. You have to look at the details of that call. You know, what was happening at that exact moment? What was the tone of the caller's voice? What specific questions were asked by the operator or the responding officers?
Mm-hmm.
You're basically putting together a picture of what was going on in everybody's mind at the time.
Oh.
Okay. You're playing detective, trying to decipher the true motive behind what they were saying.
Mm.
Was the caller really just focused on getting help, or were they already thinking ahead to building a legal case?
And I imagine that's not always an easy distinction to make, right? Like, there's got to be some gray area there.
Oh, absolutely. There are definitely some gray areas. For example, someone might start out by describing an immediate threat,
Right.
but then they'll offer up information that seems, well, more geared towards making the other person look bad.
Like, he's hitting me. There's, oh, by the way, he also did this last week and the week before.
Exactly. Or the police might arrive on scene where, you know, the emergency has already passed.
Right.
But then they start asking questions that seem designed to, you know, get the person to say something that could be used against them.
So the line between like a real emergency response and an actual police interrogation, it can get a little blurry.
Absolutely. And that's often where these legal battles take place.
Yep.
Right. Defense attorneys will argue that the police went too far, that they were really just gathering evidence while pretending to respond to an emergency.
Mm.
And I'm sure prosecutors push back, you know, saying the officers were just doing their jobs, trying to figure out what happened.
Right. They have to ask questions to make sure they understand the situation and to ensure everyone's safe.
Right. So it ultimately falls on the judge to sort through all of it and determine what the main purpose of the questioning really was.
Okay.
Was it to handle the emergency or was it to build a case for prosecution?
It sounds like a really tough judgment call.
Yeah.
With a lot of room for interpretation.
It is. And that's actually one of the criticisms of this whole primary purpose test.
Mm.
Some legal experts have argued that it's too subjective, too difficult to apply in a consistent way.
Yeah.
You know, different judges might look at the same set of facts and come to different conclusions.
So like a 911 call that's admissible in one court could get tossed out in another, even if the situations are pretty similar.
That's possible, and that that lack of predictability, it can be really frustrating for everyone involved.
Yeah, for sure.
It also raises some concerns about fairness and an equal treatment under the law.
Yeah, because if a case hinges on something as subjective as this primary purpose thing, it almost feels like a coin toss.
Exactly, and some people are very critical of that. They say that the test gives individual judges too much power, and that you know, it creates these inconsistencies in how the confrontation clause is applied across the board.
It's almost like judges have to become mind readers.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out what the person was thinking when they said something, right?
Right. And that's a tough job, especially when you're dealing with something as stressful and, you know, as chaotic as a 911 call.
Absolutely. Okay. So we've talked about how this primary purpose test works in theory.
Yeah.
But now I'm really interested to see how it actually plays out in real life, you know, in real courtrooms.
Yeah, that's a great point. In part three, we'll look at some real world examples of cases where this primary purpose test was put to the test, so to speak.
Okay.
We'll see how judges interpreted it, what kind of evidence they considered, and how it ultimately impacted the case.
Awesome. Let's get to those examples.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the theory behind Davis v. Washington.
Right.
And that whole primary purpose test. But now let's see how it's actually being used, you know, in real cases.
Yeah, that's where it gets really interesting because, as you might imagine, there's been tons of litigation around the Davis case.
Hmm.
It seems like every time a 911 call ends up in court, you know, everybody's trying to figure out what the caller's primary purpose really was.
Yeah. So let's dive into some of those courtroom battles. Can you give me an example of a case where this primary purpose test really came into play?
Yeah, there's a fascinating case out of Ohio State v. Byrd that really shows how nuanced this whole issue can be.
Yeah.
In this case, a woman called 911 to report that her boyfriend was assaulting her and threatening her with a gun. Sounds like a classic emergency, right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I mean, she's calling for help in the middle of a dangerous situation. So what happened?
Well, during that 911 call, the woman, she went beyond just describing the assault that was happening. She actually started giving the operator, you know, a pretty detailed history of her boyfriend's past violence.
Oh, wow.
Talking about, you know, previous incidents of abuse.
So even though she was calling for help in that moment, she was also providing information that, well, that could be used against him later.
Exactly. And that's where things get tricky, right? Was she just trying to give them more context or was she intentionally trying to give them evidence
for
a potential prosecution down the road?
So what did the court decide? Did they allow those statements about past abuse to be used as evidence?
Well, the Ohio Supreme Court ultimately ruled that those statements about past violence were actually testimonial.
Okay.
They said those statements, they weren't really necessary to resolve the crisis that was happening right then and there.
They weren't essential for the police to, you know, understand what was happening and send help.
Exactly. The court was basically saying, look, if you're calling 911 to get the police to stop an assault that's happening, Why are you telling them about things that happened weeks or months ago? That sounds like you're building a case.
Yeah. So even though she was clearly, distressed and in need of help, the court recognized that her statements could also be used to paint her boyfriend as a violent person.
Right.
And, potentially influence the jury against him.
Exactly. And so, they had to weigh the need for that evidence against the defendant's right to confront the person who's making those accusations.
Yeah.
Tough decision. It really shows how judges are grappling with the implications of Davis.
Okay, so the context is key.
Yeah.
But it's not just about the caller's statements themselves, right?
Right.
We also have to consider how the police, how they interact with the person who's calling, what questions they ask.
Absolutely. That's another piece of the puzzle. And there's a case out of California, People v. Cage, that really highlights that. In that case, the police responded to a domestic disturbance.
Okay.
And they found a woman who was, visibly upset, and she was claiming her boyfriend had assaulted her.
So far, it sounds pretty similar to that Ohio case we were just talking about. What was different here?
Well, in this case, instead of focusing on her safety and, getting her medical attention, the police started asking her very specific questions about the assault. They wanted details like, when did it happen? Where did it happen? What exactly did he do?
And yeah.
Things like that.
It sounds like they were already treating her like a witness in, an investigation rather than someone who needed immediate help.
Exactly. And the California Supreme Court, they noticed that. They said that that the questioning went way beyond what was necessary to figure out what was happening right then and there.
Okay.
It was clearly geared towards gathering evidence for a future trial.
So basically the court said, hold on, the emergency is over. You can't just turn this person into a witness without giving the defendant a chance to question her about it.
Right. And in the end, they actually threw out the woman's statements because her boyfriend never had the opportunity to challenge her version of events in court.
Wow. So it's a good reminder to law enforcement that, how you talk to people during an emergency, it can have a huge impact on whether that evidence is going to hold up later in court.
Absolutely. Davis has really forced police departments to go back and, rethink their training, making sure that officers understand that there's a difference between getting information to resolve an emergency and gathering evidence for a trial.
Yeah, it's a tough line to walk, no doubt.
Right.
But this whole primary purpose test, that's what it's all about, right? Finding that line. And it's definitely causing a lot of debate and legal challenges.
Yeah, and there are really good arguments on both sides. Prosecutors will argue that, the Davis decision makes it harder to hold abusers accountable, especially in domestic violence cases where victims are often hesitant to testify.
And I'm sure the defense attorneys argue that that the test is too subjective and that it gives police too much power to manipulate the situation to get the evidence they need.
It's a perfect example of how the law has to, adapt and evolve as things change. Davis gives us a framework, but putting it into practice is never going to be easy.
It's like that saying, easy cases make bad law, right? Yeah. The tough cases, the ones that are really complicated, those are the ones that force us to really examine our laws and how they actually work in real life.
Absolutely. And Davis v. Washington is definitely one of those complex cases. It's one that we'll probably be debating, for years to come.
Well, this has been a really interesting deep dive. And I think we all learned a lot about, the nuances of the Confrontation Clause and the lasting impact of Davis v. Washington.
Yeah, it's a case with really wide-reaching implications, and not just for domestic violence, but really for any situation where a 911 call or any statement made during an emergency could be used in court.
So the next time you're, watching the news and you hear a 911 call being played, think about this primary purpose test and ask yourself, was this a desperate plea for help or was this the start of building a legal case?
No, the answer might surprise you.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you found it informative and something to think about.
Thanks for listening.